This evening we're going to continue on in this diagram here. We're going to look at stage 3 and 4. But before I do that, is there any more questions from any of the practice today that anyone would like to bring up? Yeah. You have, sorry?
Hay fever.
Hay fever.
And as a result, my eyes are dry. And so far, I've figured out I have two options. I can either blink frequently and disturb myself a little bit every time I blink, or I can hold myself back and then blink.
You can do what, sorry?
Hold myself back and then blink every five minutes, and then
I think the option that causes least disturbance, distraction. I mean, of course, this is with your eyes open, yeah? You're meditating.
Yeah.
And like some eye drops or something wouldn't help?
Not quite, yeah.
Not really? Of course, that's not an ideal scenario, but I guess the one that causes less disturbance would be the preferable one.
And the second question, the similar question, is that my nose is hot-blocked, and as a result, if I breathe really calmly, I still generate a little bit of whizzing noise. And as a result, whenever I concentrate on breathing, I sometimes tend to actually concentrate on the noise or the sound instead of the sensation. Is that fine?
Well, it's probably better to focus on that than thinking about breakfast. So, that could be a little bit like counting the breaths, you know, to keep you a little bit on target. But of course, eventually then just as much as you can slowly let go of focusing on the sound. But again, it's probably the less of two evils that than just allowing the mind to wander everywhere. So that's what I'd recommend. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Okay. So let's go back to the chart here. So we're talking about these 9 stages, sometimes called 9 mental abidings, because we're trying to abide better and better on the object. These 9 stages on the way to shamatha. Shamatha is the diagram in the middle at the top. And yesterday we looked at stages 1 and 2. So let's just briefly review those. So remember, the elephant was the mind. The fact that it was black was symbolizing this laxity or dullness. The monkey was symbolizing conceptual thought in general, and the fact that it's black is symbolizing this excitement. And the meditator down there has in the left hand, the rope of mindfulness, in the right hand, the hook of introspection, the 2 main tools. And we can see at this first stage called setting the mind, they're both, the monkey and the elephant are running wildly ahead of the meditator, basically to signify that at the first stage of practice, we just really recognize how out of control and chaotic our mind really is, that our mind is full of distractions, full of dullness. And so at the first stage of practice, we're not really able to focus on the object very long at all, maybe even just a few seconds, and then most of the time we're heavily distracted or heavily dull. So again, the first sign or the first sign of progress in practice is just to notice how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. Because until we try to focus on a given object, we may live in the illusion that our mind is not too bad, that, you know, my attention skills are not too bad. But when we try to focus on a given object, we can come to see that actually our mind is very much out of control. But of course, if we persist with our practice, we can get to stage 2 in the practice, which was called continuous setting. Here we see elephant, monkey not running so fast, a little bit of white on the top of their heads. signifying the fact of stability and clarity. So at the second stage, we're starting to notice some periods in our meditation where our mind is settling down a little bit more, and sometimes we can hold the object maybe a minute or two before we get distracted. But even at the second stage of practice, we are more off the object than we are on the object. But if we continue our practice, we can get around the corner to stage three. So we see stage three and four are on the third road. This third road is the road of mindfulness, or is signifying the power of mindfulness, which means that by stage three and four, our mindfulness now is getting quite good. Meaning at stage three, our mindfulness is much better. We can see there the rope of mindfulness is tied to the elephant of the mind. So by stage three, we can now hold the object for longer periods of time, maybe up to 5 or 10 minutes, before we become distracted. And now at stage three, we quickly recognize when we're distracted. And that is symbolized by the elephant turning the head backwards, meaning we come back to the object quite quickly now. Now at stage three, we also see the rabbit has come into the picture. And stage three here has been translated as resetting, meaning that we quickly reset the mind on the object when we become distracted. The rabbit has come into the picture now on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing what's called subtle dullness or subtle laxity, because by stage three, our mindfulness is getting a lot better, meaning we can hold the object for longer periods of time, and if we get distracted, we quickly come back to the object. So even though our mindfulness is getting a lot better, the quality of our holding still needs a lot of work. The clarity is really missing a lot still. And so here, the rabbit is symbolizing this subtle dullness. So by stage three, we need to start to pick up the fact when our mind is a little bit dull. Of course, the rabbit was there from the very beginning, but at stage one and two, we had much more serious problems than a little bit of subtle dullness to worry about. But by stage three now, subtle dullness becomes an issue, because if we can't pick up the fact that our mind is a little bit dull, we may think that by stage three we're nearly at shamatha already, because we can hold the object pretty well and hardly ever get distracted and very quickly come back. But still we've got a lot of work to do. So we need to notice then that our mind is not very sharp, is not very clear, to notice this subtle dullness. So this is stage three of the practice. So let's have a look now what Alan Wallace says about stage three of the practice. So read a little bit from his book here, page 43. When you reach the third stage, and he calls it resurgent attention, during each practice session, your attention is fixed most of the time upon your meditative object. By now, you will have increased the duration of each session beyond the initial 24 minutes to perhaps twice that. So as I said, I think yesterday or earlier today, as we progress in the practice, we'll need to start to make our sessions a bit longer. But we don't want to, go from 24 to 48 in one jump. Often it's recommended, increments of maybe 3 to 5 minutes. So if you're doing 25 minutes and then after some time you feel that's very easy and comfortable, maybe you can go to like 30 minutes, for example. And so by stage three here, he's suggesting that we can meditate maybe for up to an hour in one session. As your attention gradually stabilizes, you may increase the duration of each session by increments of 3 minutes. At all times, though, value the quality of your meditation over the quantity of time spent in each session. If you sit for long periods but let your mind rove around unnoticed among distractions or fall into dullness, you not only are wasting your not only are you wasting your time, but you are also developing bad habits that will only get harder and harder to break. So remember again, quality over quantity. If we're meditating too long, we're just going to get caught up in dullness and distraction, and we're just going to increase those habits when we're trying to decrease them. When you were still on the second stage, although you experienced periods when your attention was continually engaged with the meditative object for as long as a minute, most of the time you were still caught up in distractions. When you reach the third stage, your attentional stability is increased so that most of the time you remain engaged with the object. Occasionally there are still lapses when you completely forget the object, but you quickly recognize them and patch up these holes in the continuity of attention. Long before you achieve this stage, you may occasionally have a session in which your mind seems to remain on the object most of the time. But don't be fooled. Even amateur golfers occasionally hit a birdie, but that doesn't mean they're ready to go on the pro circuit. The third stage is achieved only when your mind remains focused on the object most of the time in virtually all your sessions. For most people, the primary problem in this phase of practice is still coarse excitation, and it is with the power of mindfulness that you accomplish this third stage. And then a little bit more on page 45. Many people appear to achieve the second stage while meditating just one or two sessions each day. In their more focused sessions, they experience periods of continuity of attention. But such stability is lost during the day as they engage in other activities. Shamatha meditation can be very helpful even in the midst of a normal, socially active way of life, especially when it is balanced with other kinds of spiritual practice, such as the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion. Rounded, integrated practice is like maintaining a healthy diet. While a proper diet won't necessarily heal imbalance and illness, it is still indispensable for maintaining your vitality and resistance to disease. Likewise, a balanced meditative practice in the course of a socially engaged way of life heightens your psychological immune system so that you are less vulnerable to mental imbalances of all kinds. If you are practicing only a session or two each day, you may not progress beyond the second attentional stage. The reason for this is simple. If you are balancing your attention for an hour or so each day, but letting it become fragmented and distracted for the other 15 hours of waking time each day, then the attentional coherence cultivated during these brief sessions is overwhelmed by the distractions of the rest of the day. The achievement of the stage of resurgent attention requires a greater commitment to practice. This will entail multiple sessions of meditation each day, practiced within a quiet, contemplative way of life that supports the cultivation of inner calm and collectedness. And we're going to talk about what that entails a few days' time in the evening. The key to success is to conduct your life between sessions in such a way that you don't lose the ground you have gained. So that's stage three. So let's now have a brief look at stage four. So stage four here is called close setting. Now our mindfulness is getting quite very good, so much so that we can now hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. But still we have a lot of work to do in terms of the quality of our holding. We had earlier a question about, you know, this background noise. So this is what we're talking about here in the following stages, is that we still have to do a lot of work on the quality of our holding. There's still a lot of background noise, a lot of things, other things going on in the mind at the same time, even though we never completely lose the object. So let's have a look at what Alan Wallace says about stage four. So this is on page 59. By maintaining continuity of this training in a retreat setting, you will eventually achieve the fourth of the nine stages of attentional development, called close attention. At this point, due to the power of enhanced mindfulness, you no longer completely forget your chosen object, the tactile sensations of the breath at the nostrils. You may have experienced glimpses of this level of attentional stability intermittently before actually achieving this stage, but now it has become normal. Each of your sessions now may last an hour or longer, and throughout this time your attention cannot be involuntarily drawn entirely away from the object. You are now free of coarse excitation. It's as if the attention has acquired a kind of gravity such that it can't be easily buffeted by gusts of involuntary thoughts and sensory distractions. And then a little bit over on page 62. As mentioned previously, in the fourth stage of shamatha practice, you achieve the power of mindfulness, and the practice comes into its own. While your attention is no longer prone to coarse excitation, it is still flawed by a medium degree of excitation and coarse laxity. When medium excitation occurs, you don't completely lose track of your object of attention, but involuntary thoughts occupy the center of your attention and the meditative object is displaced to the periphery. To compare this with coarse excitation, let's again take the analogy of tuning into a radio station. Coarse excitation is like losing your chosen station altogether as your tuner slips either to another station or into mere static. Medium excitation is like drifting slightly toward another station, but not so completely that you can no longer hear your chosen station at all. You still hear it, but it's muffled by extraneous noise. The achievement of the fourth stage brings with it a sense of accomplishment. You are now an experienced shamatha trainee, no longer a complete beginner. If you have not gained a sound conceptual understanding of the entire shamatha path, you might well think you have already come to its culmination. This can easily give rise to some degree of complacency concerning your meditative practice, which brings its own dangers. Any questions about stage 3 or 4? Okay. A couple more things. One is objects. As I mentioned a couple of times now, the recommended object is the one that works best for you. And for many of us, that will probably be the breath. But in the meditation texts, a number of different objects are mentioned that are suitable, including, we talked a little bit earlier about the mental image of a Buddha. This is very much emphasized in some of the Tibetan traditions because it's also then a prelude to Tantra or Vajrayana practice where we're doing a lot of visualization. But in this book, and what we're doing in this retreat, is focusing on three particular objects: the breath, the mind, and then this awareness of awareness practice. And the reason is because I think all three of them have tremendous advantages for us in our modern day society. And so this is also what Alan Wallace is basically saying in his book here. So I'll just read a little bit about his recommendations for shamatha practice, the objects. And this is on page 6. He says, to guide meditators along these 10 stages, so the 10 stages, of course, are the 9 stages plus shamatha, the result, I have chosen from Buddhist teachings 3 techniques that I have found effective for people in the modern life, in the modern world. These 3 techniques are the basis for the 3 divisions of this book. For the first 4 stages, you should practice whatever method you find easiest. By stage 5, the mind is relatively stable and you can move on to subtler techniques. For achieving the first four stages, I recommend the practice of mindfulness of breathing, variations of which can be found in Zen, Vipassana, and Tibetan Buddhism. Mindfulness of breathing means settling your awareness on the sensations involved in breathing, continually returning your attention there whenever your mind wanders. Beginning with the fifth stage, I recommend a method called settling the mind in its natural state. So that's the name he gives to the second practice of observing the mind. He calls it settling the mind in its natural state. In this technique, you direct your attention to mental experiences, all the events, that is, thoughts, mental images and emotions, that arise in the domain of the mind. This method is drawn from the Dzogchen, or Great Perfection lineage, that's within the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, but is found in other Buddhist traditions as well. With the instructions for the eighth attentional stage onward, we move on to the still subtler practice of maintaining awareness of awareness itself. The technique is called shamatha without an object. Here the practice is not so much one of developing attentional stability and vividness as it is of discovering the stillness and luminosity inherent in awareness itself. The training in mindfulness of breathing may be helpful to anyone, including those seeking to prevent or treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. Many people find the second practice, that of settling the mind in its natural state, to be more challenging, but some meditators take to it naturally. Likewise, the practice of awareness is subtler still, but it may be optimal from the beginning for those who are strongly drawn to it. You may use any one of the three methods to progress along all 10 stages of attentional development, or you may follow the sequence described in this book. How fast you progress will depend on the level of your commitment and the degree to which your lifestyle and environment support such practice. So in general, with the shamatha practice, when we have chosen a particular object, then it's very much recommended to stay with that object, to use that object all the way to shamatha. So that is the normal recommendation. But here in this book, Alan Wallace is also saying that's one possibility and a valid thing to do. But he's also suggesting that what you could do is, on particularly the first four stages, use the mindfulness of breathing, the breath as the object, and then from stage five up to stage eight to use the mind as the object, and then for the last two stages to simply rest in awareness. So this is also an option. What we don't want to do is keep changing the object from one week to the next. That's not going to be very effective. Now, if we want to use the sensations of the breath all the way to shamatha, then we need to do something happens regarding that. Because as we progress along the shamatha path, our sense faculties actually start to shut down. So you can't actually focus on the sensations of the breath all the way to shamatha. But what happens is, as we go along the shamatha path and our practice improves, then at some point along the path, we get what's called the acquired sign. The acquired sign is a mental image related to the air element, related to the breath, that spontaneously appears in our mind. When that appears, it's not something we generate, it just spontaneously appears due to our progress in the practice. Then we switch from the sensations of the breath to this mental image called the acquired sign, and we use that the rest of the way to shamatha. And then when we get to shamatha, we achieve another thing called the counterpart sign. So to talk a little bit more about what this acquired sign and counterpart sign is, I'd like to read a little bit again from Alan Wallace's book here, when he talks about this. So first, the acquired sign, he talks about that on page 64, halfway down. Or the first two paragraphs, sorry. In the phases of mindfulness of breathing thus far, you have been attending in various ways to the tactile sensations of the respiration. However, to continue all the way along the path of shamatha, eventually you must shift your attention from the tactile sensations of breathing to what's called an acquired sign, a symbol of the air element that appears before your mind's eye as you progress in shamatha practice. To different people, acquired signs associated with the breath practice may appear like a star, a cluster of gems or pearls, a wreath of flowers, a puff of smoke, a cobweb, a cloud, a lotus flower, a wheel, or the moon or sun. The various appearances of the acquired sign are related to the mental dispositions of individual meditators. If you wish to continue on the path of mindfulness of breathing, which here explicitly turns into mindfulness with breathing, as soon as such a sign arises, shift your attention to this sign. This will be your object of attention as you proceed or along the rest of the 9 stages leading to shamatha. At first, your sign will arise only sporadically, so when it disappears, return to the previous sensations of the breath. But eventually it will appear more regularly and steadily, and from that point onward, focus your attention on this object. As you progress in this practice, increase the duration of your sessions for as long as you're able to maintain a quality of attention relatively free of laxity and excitation. And then to talk about the counterpart sign, he talks about that on page 157. He says the following. The Theravada tradition gives this specific description of achieving shamatha by way of mindfulness of the respiration. You begin this practice as described earlier by focusing on the tactile sensations of the breath, which are the sign for preliminary practice. Eventually you shift your attention to the acquired sign of the breath, which becomes your meditative object until you achieve shamatha, at which point a third sign appears spontaneously. This is called the counterpart sign of the breath, which is a subtle, emblematic representation of the whole quality of the air element. Buddhaghosa described this sign as follows. So Buddhaghosa, of course, is a great Theravada master, and he says the following. The counterpart sign appears as if breaking out from the acquired sign, and 100 times, 1,000 times more purified, like a looking glass disc drawn from its case, like a mother of pearl dish well washed, like the moon's disc coming out from behind the cloud, like cranes against a thundercloud. But it has neither colour nor shape. It is born only in the perception in one who has obtained concentration, being a mere model of appearance. Sounds interesting. Any questions?
So, when we choose an object, when we do shamatha, we need to stick to this object. But what if we like two objects?
Well, then you can experiment with those two objects. But, of course, if we're only doing a little bit of shamatha practice each day, then, you know, it's probably no big deal to do two objects. But if we really want to progress along these stages, and particularly if we want to go into like a retreat setting, then I think we really need to focus on one given object to really make that progress. But if we, you know, for example, if we like the breath and we like looking at the mind, and for example, we do two sessions a day, we can do breath in the morning and the mind in the evening. That's no problem. I mean, of course, that's helpful, but if we really want to make some substantial progress, particularly, like I said, in doing many sessions a day or doing retreat, then we really need to pick one object and work with that.
Okay. How about using the breath as a kind of preliminary practice to the mind?
Yes.
I remember I'm also kind of a combo, that if you combine two gatikas, like the first would be the
mindfulness breathing in order to kind of calm down. And then the second would be the settling the mind.
I mean, of course, yes, we can do that. And then, of course, probably if you're doing a retreat setting, you wouldn't do that all sessions. Maybe you'd start with a breath in the first session in the morning, then work with the mind. So that would be fine. And also, what you can do, of course, is as part of the preparation at the beginning of a meditation, you can use the breath as we've been doing the full body to prepare the mind to settle down for 5 minutes or so, then move on to using the mind the rest of the session. Also, as we're going to see tomorrow when we start to work with the mind, you can, even if you're using the mind, you can anchor yourself a little bit in the breath as a beginner, which we're going to talk a little bit about tomorrow as well. Also, of course, if we're working with the mind and then on a particular occasion we find ourselves completely tense or stressed or whatever, we can sort of go back to focusing on the breath in the body for some minutes to calm down and then go back to the mind. So we can use that as a little bit of a backup in case we need it. So all of these variations are suitable.
Instead of achieving, Alan Wallace is also saying, like, accomplishing samatha.
Yeah.
Do you want to comment it?
Accomplish, okay. Achieve.
Like, accomplish. Is this the right word? Like that, everybody, like, we have a samatha already.
He talks about sometimes about cultivating versus discovering. Is that what you mean? That's a little bit the perspective. And it comes together with the practice, which perspective we have. I mean, it's a little bit like the analogy, if we got a window and there's dirt on the window, we can have at least two perspectives of that. We can say, there's a dirty window. I need to put effort to clean it, to produce a clean window. Yeah, to accomplish, to achieve a clean window, yeah, to cultivate, you know. Or we can say, there's actually a clean window already there. We just need to remove the dirt to discover the clean window that was already there. I mean, the end result is the same, isn't it? It's just perspective. And so with the breath practice and the mind practice, we have more the perspective of cultivation. So that's why we have this model here, this 9-stage model, they're called the 9 mental abidings. It means we're trying to make the mind abide better and better on the object. So that's the sort of the perspective we have. Whereas when we come to, for example, the awareness of awareness practice, we have the other perspective. We're just resting in awareness itself and discovering these inner qualities of the mind which were already there to begin with. So in that model, and some traditions like the, as we saw in the book here, the Dzogchen tradition, the Mahamudra tradition, when they talk about shamatha practice, they tend to use that approach in terms of practice. And there, you won't see this 9-stage model, because this is more the cultivating approach or perspective. In that approach, you'll see a 4-stage model. And that will come up a little bit later in the book, but just to briefly mention it. So that 4-stage model, so this 9-stage model is like we're trying to make our mind abide better and better on the object. You know? In that one, where it's about the discovery approach. And in that one, it's about the event perspective. How are the events unfolding in the mind? And the first stage in that model, the first stage of progress is you notice a waterfall of thoughts crashing down on you. Yeah. Then if we progress, then their mind starts to settle down. Instead of a waterfall of thoughts crashing down, it becomes a fast-flowing river of thoughts. And then as our mind settles down more, then the fast-flowing river of thoughts becomes a slow-moving river of thoughts. And eventually, when we achieve shamatha, that empties into a still lake. The mind is still. So therefore you see this model because of that perspective. So it's just really the different perspective. So Alan Wallace is often talking about the cultivating approach or the discovery approach or the discovery model. And it really comes from the perspective. And that is what we find in the spiritual path, in the different Tibetan traditions, you know. Like, for instance, the Lam Rim is the cultivating model. You know, Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. This is where I am now. There's enlightenment. These are the steps I need to cultivate to get to that goal of enlightenment. Whereas this, what was briefly mentioned here, the Dzogchen and Mahamudra, is more the discovery approach. And so they take the perspective of the enlightened state from the beginning. We just need to strip away all these mental afflictions to discover the Buddha that's already within us. So that reflects in the type of language and the perspective of the practices, and similarly here in the shamatha practice. Okay.
Achieving the end goal, or achieving stage this, or achieving that, and then we start like thinking, oh, I suck, because I'm not still on level there, or I haven't achieved shamatha, so I suck. And he says that if you take the Tibetan word they use, then basically they're saying that I'm accomplishing shamatha right now. Every moment that I'm deciding to bring my back and mind back from wandering to the object, every moment when I'm taking control of my mind, or even that moment, I'm basically accomplishing shamatha, because it's worthwhile, because I'm cultivating a healthy approach to my mind. Mm-hmm.
So that's bringing it into the present. Yeah. And one more thing to mention on these two perspectives. Both of them, of course, have advantages and disadvantages, you know. You know, as Mick said, the cultivating approach is, oh, that's too difficult. I can't do that. I'm just hopeless. I'll never make it. That's the disadvantage. The disadvantage of the other approach is, particularly if we talk about this, you know, the Buddha within, the mind's already pure. I don't need to do anything. My mind's already pure, you know. I'm already enlightened. So, you know, both of them have advantages and disadvantages. And so I think it's sometimes good to have a combined approach and not to go to the extremes of either of them. But what Mick said was a very valid point, is that if we're looking at the cultivator approach, that everything we do, we are accomplishing. We're bringing it into the present. We're not sort of looking into the future. So I think that's a very important point. Anything else? Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if there is a stage where we cannot fall back.
I think this will come in the book later, but to use an analogy, you know, let's say we go to the gym and we do 6 months or a year of intensive training and we get quite fit. If we stop going to the gym, do we stay at that level? No. So similarly here, whatever level we get to, if we stop, then we'll slowly go backwards. But like the gym, you know, maybe we need to do a lot of work to get up to a level, but then to maintain that level, we just need to have a certain amount of, to maintain. So similarly here. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, you can, if you put a lot of effort in retreat to get a certain level, then to maintain that level, you just need to do a certain level of practice to maintain it. But if you want to go further, of course, then more effort. Yeah. And what we're going to see is that we need to make sure that we talked about these preconditions. You know, we need to have this sort of conducive lifestyle that can support this practice. Otherwise, we can, of course, go to a 6-month retreat and go quite far, And then we jump back into our normal daily life and very quickly we'll go backwards. So we need to make sure that that our practice and retreat and so forth is supported by the type of lifestyle that we lead as well. That's also important. If you use the breath, probably the full body practice is not going to get very far. I mean, that'd be good for relaxation.
Yeah.
But, for example, some of the Theravada traditions, when they talk about the shamatha practice or the concentration, they only just talk about the abdomen. They don't really talk so much about the nostril. So I think with the abdomen you can really make a lot of progress, or the nostrils you make a lot of progress. You don't have to do them in that order, but each one is specifically useful for, relaxation, stability, clarity. So, I mean, from the very beginning you can start at the nostrils and just work with that. That's fine. That's fine. Okay, let's leave it there. So we'll go back into our normal evening Shavasana corpse posture meditation. So find yourself some nice space. So again, if your neighbour is too relaxed and starts snoring, you can gently nudge them. So if someone's nudging you, that's the reason. So letting go of any external distractions and allow your awareness to descend into the body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face, the mouth and jaw soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining that ongoing flow of mindfulness, of the sensations of the breath, throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. conclusion, we can dedicate all the positive potential that we've gathered here together today towards the goal of developing our attention skills, towards the goal of developing or cultivating a calm, clear and focused mind. And we can also dedicate towards cultivating compassion for ourselves and others. And again, while I read the dedication prayer from Great Indian Master Shantideva, you might like to reflect on the words. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.